You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers. Translated by Elizabeth Marshall, this is the second lecture of 13 lectures, given in Dornach on the 25th of June, 1922. Yesterday I attempted to show in a rather obscure way how we can find the transition from the spatial physical, including human corporeality, to what can be thought of as spiritual, in that three dimensions are reduced in a sense to two or one dimensions and to a point. Now, today I want to contrast yesterday's observations to some extent with a more cosmic point of view, which should show you how we can also develop ideas relating the world that forms our environment to the soul spiritual. For modern consciousness, it is completely impossible to view the material world surrounding us in a way that the soul spiritual in human beings has a direct relationship to it. We have to explain this cognitively, if the modern person is not to say they cannot understand why anthroposophy alleges that the soul spiritual, meaning the I, capital, and the astral body, leave the physical and ether bodies and are then outside of them. Where are they? Asks that person, whose understanding is grounded in modern materialistic consciousness. A modern person is incapable of thinking that the soul is to be found somewhere in space. At most, they are able to think that air is somewhere in space, that space is filled with light. But that the soul spiritual is somewhere in space, this they cannot think. And from this impossibility, it is but a short path to the other, that this modern person who has grown up with a materialistic awareness is incapable of imagining where the soul spiritual goes when it leaves the human body at death. Of course, the modern person claims to be able to believe these things. However, at that moment, when they have to use their own faculty of thought, they immediately get into various conflicts. These conflicts cease when we try to understand spiritual science. But the ideas we then have to absorb are so unfamiliar for contemporary human beings that they can only approach them slowly and gradually. Therefore, it is good to begin with the facts of soul spiritual life, facts that nowadays are little known in the outside world. As we all know, what humanity has today as venerable old traditional beliefs that have flowed into the various religions can be traced back to an age-old knowledge. We know that in ancient times there were sacred mystery sites, which were churches, schools, and centers for the arts in one, and from where there originated all that has spread out among the mass of the people as knowledge, but also as impulses determining people's actions. In these mystery schools, there were so-called initiates who had achieved a higher awareness through having undergone specific processes. Through the trials they had experienced, they had gained a certain relationship to the world through which they could learn about world processes, world developments in whichever area they were interested in. In external history, we only find a degenerate kind of notion of world processes. You have all read about how in Greek temples, oracle sites, they made use of certain personalities, a kind of medium, who through exposure to vapors arising from the earth would fall into what nowadays people who have only a dilettantish idea of the spiritual would call a trance. This sort of trance is a spurious kind of hocus-pocus, which does not reveal the truth or any aspect of reality. However, in those times when the ancient paths of relating to the world had already degenerated, people took refuge in these oracles, and they accepted what was revealed in these trance-like states as revelations, so as to understand what the intentions of the real spiritual powers were, those divine spiritual powers, which are really behind all that happens in the world. They then acted in accordance with the revelations of the oracles. However, these oracles were not the originals. Those were something very different. At the time, people sought refuge in the oracles. The old faculties that initiates had cultivated in the mysteries were lost, and the oracles had resorted to external procedures. I would like to describe to you one of these procedures through which, in very ancient times, the initiates of the mysteries listened to the secrets of the world, the secrets of the intentions of the divine spiritual beings, which are behind all natural phenomena. Such initiates prepared their whole person, over a long period of time, to pay careful attention to life processes, and they could put themselves into a certain emotional state at the time of the rising sun. This was an exercise that the ancient initiates practiced repeatedly, putting themselves into a very receptive, spiritually receptive, state at dawn toward the rising sun. Particularly the dawn, the rising sun should evoke in these old initiates a reverential soul state permeated by feelings of devotion. We cannot imagine today what such a state these initiates achieved in the face of the rising sun was like. If they were properly prepared, then it was part devotion, part thirst for knowledge. I think we can only catch a glimpse of such feelings toward the external world, and this is more than a century ago, when we read the beautiful descriptions that Johann Gottfried Herder, that fine poet and writer, gave of the dawn, not as a more modern, more trivial writer would have done, but from the dawn as a symbol for all awakenings, awakenings not just in nature, but in the human soul. In a way, this evokes in the human soul itself a kind of dawn, as if the sun is rising internally. Herder described this wonderfully as he attempted to show how the poetic mood had once made itself felt in human development, and how this poetic mood could originate with what people could experience at dawn in the face of the rising sun. The secrets of the dawn and of the rising sun were felt even more intensively by people like Jacob Boehme, whose first work, as you know, is titled Aurora, or The Dawning of the Day in the East. And the words, such as those in Goethe's Faust, are not unrelated to the mysteries of the dawn. Quote, "Disciple, up, untiring, hasten, to bathe thy breast in morning red." Close quote. The further we go back in the history of human development, the more wonderful we find the moods of the human soul at the first rays of the morning sun, which are in a sense carrying in on their waves the vital active light of the world. The ancient initiates in the mystery schools had prepared themselves so that they could send out from their hearts into the expanses of the world their most serious, most holy questions to the world spirits during the dawn. They said to themselves, "When the sun sends out the first ray of light to the earth, this offers the best way for human questions to flow out to the expanses of the cosmos." And so, in a sense, these initiates radiated their questions, the riddles of their hearts and of humanity, out into the wide expanses of the world. And then they did not approach the answer in a trivial or banal way, as we would do today in our physical sciences, but put themselves into a mood in which they said, "Now we have transmitted our riddles and questions to the cosmic expanses. Now they rest in the bosom of the world. The gods will receive our riddles and questions." I am only describing here. We can think what we like about these things, but once they existed, and this was how things were done, then the initiates waited, and during the night hours they prepared their hearts to be receptive. This in turn was not a mood in which questions were raised, but a responsive one, in which they opened their hearts to a receptive and devotional mood. And they brought their devotion to the full moon shining down upon them. And then they felt, "Now we are receiving the answers from the universe." In the old mysteries, this was a very common process. At a certain point in time, they offered their questions as a covenant with the world by sending them out and then they received the answers, which at the full moon, in the light of the full moon, were sent to earth by the gods. This is how people used to communicate with the world. They were not so arrogant as to pose a question in their heads and then to look for the answer immediately, as do philosophers today, or so arrogant as to think that they could sit down with a blank piece of paper and work out the great riddles of humanity on their own. In fact, these old initiates believed that they could communicate with the divine spiritual powers, which flow in and through the world, about the questions and answers relating to the riddles of the world. They did this because they knew that outside in the world are not only the content of physical sense perceptions, but also, flowing in and through everything, is the spiritual. And when the ray of sun touches me, I can send out to it the substance of my will. This secret is wholly lost in human research. It was once real knowledge, actual human insight. One of the last people in Europe to have a not really clear but still lively tradition in these things, and who was also prepared to fight, was Julian the Apostate. He was incautious enough to still take these things seriously and thus succumbed to his opponents. The modern human being would sketch, this is only a rough diagram, but it is just to show what the issue is. The earth and the sun, there would of course have to be a much greater distance between them, so that the sun sends its rays down to the earth. The old initiate would have said, this is just physical. The spiritual aspect is that people are living on the earth, and there they develop their will, and while the sun's rays come down to the earth, human beings can send their will in the direction of the sun up into the universe, and there's a diagram. The old initiates sent their questions out into the cosmos, in a sense on the crest of these waves of will, which flowed out from the earth to the sun. And when a modern person says that on the other side is the moon, which sends its light down onto the earth, the old initiate says, that is just the physical. In truth, thoughts come down to the earth on these waves of moonlight. So the old initiates consigned their questions to the waves of will flowing from the earth to the sun, and received the answers from the waves of thought flowing from the moon to the earth. Modern scientists know only one side of this. They see only the physical aspect of the sun and the moon. However, the old initiates said, while the sun is constantly sending its light to the earth is constantly sending waves of will out into the universe, the will of all the people living on the earth. And when the human being stands in the moonlight, then waves of thought are being sent to him from the cosmos. Human organization has changed. The seeker of supersensible knowledge could not do this today. Human understanding is coarser now than it was in those days. Of course, today, too, our waves of will flow out into the cosmos. However, human beings do not care about these questions passionately enough for the waves of will to take them out into the universe. Today, we humans have become too intellectualistic, and the intellect cools all these questions down. We have little idea of the huge thirst for knowledge which people had with regard to the most sacred riddles of existence. We are no longer so thirsty for knowledge. In fact, we are just curious and want to know everything immediately without having to engage with the world. And at most we have lovers romancing in the moonlight. Scholars would think it a terrible superstition to receive the answers to the burning riddles of existence through the light of the moon. People see the world as de-spiritualized. No one knows anything about the spirit flowing all through the world, or when someone speaks about this, it is in a vague pantheistic manner, and not in the specific way of someone who knows of the relationship of the human will to the sun's rays, or that of human thought forms to the light of the moon. However, in modern initiation, we can learn to communicate with the cosmos and with the spirit of the world. But modern initiation does this differently. You can find exercises to prepare for initiation in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? These exercises are all meant to help people of today find answers, not, however, by turning over the questions in their minds and giving the answers with their minds, as modern arrogance demands. This only results in clever ideas, but cleverness does not lead to a real answer to the riddles of existence. By just turning things over in the mind, people cut themselves off from the world. If we want answers from the world, we necessarily have to go beyond ourselves. We have to relate to the world. Thus, modern initiates must pose their questions and then have patience when there is no immediate answer. Modern initiates gradually learn not to just look at the outer world to satisfy their curiosity through the impressions made on their eyes, ears, and other senses. Of course, they also receive sense impressions from outside. But by looking at the flowers, the sun, the moon, the stars, other people, plants, animals, and so on, by focusing their senses on all that is around them, and letting all these external sense impressions flow through them, they send a stream from themselves out toward all this. And this is the stream signifying the riddles of existence. Someone sees a lovely flower. They look at it, but not just passively. They focus on, for example, the yellow. They let the yellow affect them. At the same time, they send a question toward the yellow, and they let this riddle of existence immerse itself in the yellow of the flower, or in the colors of the rising sun. It is not that they give up all the questions of their hearts to a certain impression, such as the rising sun, but they pour them out into all their sense impressions. Now, if they then expected to receive the answers from these sense impressions themselves, that would be as if the old initiates had sent out their questions to the rising sun and then expected to receive the answers from it, instead of from the full moon, after having waited a while. Such an old initiate had to wait at least 14 days. They put their questions to the rising sun during the new moon, and then they received the answer at full moon. No modern philosopher would wait that long, for then, at least in the days when they printed things more quickly, the book would have had to be at the printer's. So we must be patient. When we consign our questions to the impressions of the senses, when we immerse them in the phenomena, then we should not expect that these sense impressions will reveal anything to us, and we have to wait, sometimes longer, until what we have given over to the world comes up from inside as the answer. We will be able to do this if we have taken enough time to prepare. You can rest assured that when you give your questions over to the world, you will receive responses that are purely coincidental, that give people a certain egoistic satisfaction, but which are not real answers. You must immerse your riddles in the flower, in the ocean, in the firmament, in the stars, in everything that comes to you as an impression. You immerse your riddles in all this, and then you have to wait until the answers emerge from inside you. You cannot just wait for 14 days. You cannot even, as the old initiates did, determine the time. You must wait until the right moment has come, when the outside has become the inside, and the answer comes up from inside you. Therein lies the art of spiritual research into the world, in being able to wait, in not thinking that the answer will emerge quickly. However, we will not receive answers if we do not pose questions. If you ask someone who has actually gained knowledge in the sense of modern initiation, then they will tell you, "I was perhaps 35 years old when I had certain heartfelt questions about life. At the time, I consigned these questions to some special outer impressions, and when I turned 50, the answers emerged from inside me." Today we have to immerse in the flow of time what we want to develop as a dialogue with the cosmos, just as the old initiates immersed their questions in the depths of space, so they could be reborn out of that space, the sun-like from the moon-like. And the cosmic must reappear, must be reborn out of the human soul, after a time when the cosmic powers determine themselves, so that our task is to sense correctly when a real answer from the gods appears inside us, and not just a human response to the questions we have posed. Thus, in a sense, what constituted the old initiation reappears in a different form. But you see, what is important here? You see that when human beings want to approach the great riddles of existence, then all depends on them being able to find a soul-spiritual connection to the soul-spiritual powers in the cosmos, not being hermits, wanting to resolve everything by themselves egoistically, but by being able to wait until the cosmos responds to what they themselves have sent out into the cosmos as riddles of existence. Now you see, the fact is that when we have learned to send out soul themes into the cosmos and to receive responses in return, then we are much better prepared to understand birth and death. When someone begins to understand how the soul flows out to the sun in the element of will, like a counter-current to the rays of the sun, how it flows out into all that we receive as impressions of the outside world, they are beginning to understand how the soul spiritual flows out into the world on the waves of the spiritual in the cosmos when the physical human being goes through death. And when they have learned how they receive their best thoughts from the cosmos when they return, when they emerge inside them, as is the case with modern human beings, so they also learn to understand how the spiritual flows back from the moon-like, from the semblance of the world. It is from the moon-like in their own organism that the thoughts emerge. We learn to realistically evaluate these transitory phenomena, found in between the physical cosmic and the cosmic spiritual. The modern human being, schooled only in a materialistic awareness, describes things merely on a physical level. They say there are solar eclipses, whereby the moon comes between the earth and the sun, so that the sun's rays are blocked and the sun is eclipsed. This is the next best physical explanation. When there is a light over there and here is an eye, EYE, and I put my hand between them, then the light is eclipsed, a purely spatial explanation. This is where modern consciousness comes to a standstill. However, we have to gain insight into such phenomena, which, despite appearing rather infrequently, do have their spiritual aspect. When there is a solar eclipse, then something different happens to those parts of the earth affected by it than happens when there is no solar eclipse. When we know that the rays of the sun make their way to us and our will radiates up toward the sun, then we can imagine how such a solar eclipse can have a certain influence on the rays of the will, which are spiritual. The moon blocks the light rays. That is a purely physical process. The rays of the will cannot be blocked by the physical matter of the moon. They radiate out into the darkness, and there is a time, albeit a short time, when what is will-like on the earth flows out into space in a different way than it does when there is no solar eclipse. Normally, the physical aspect of the sun's light connects to the rays of will being sent out. In this case, the rays of the will flow out unhindered into the cosmos in a cone of light. The old initiates knew that in such a case, all the unbridled will, the untamed instincts and drives that human beings hold in themselves, flow out into the universe. And they taught their students that normally what the evil will of human beings radiates out into the cosmos is in a sense burned up by the sun's rays, so that it only harms humans themselves and does no damage in the cosmos. When, however, there is a solar eclipse, then there is the chance that all the evil of the earth spreads out into the cosmic heavens. This is a physical phenomenon which has a quite clear spiritual aspect. And when there is a lunar eclipse. Modern consciousness says that the Earth is between the Sun and the Moon. Therefore, we see the shadow of the Earth on the Moon. This is a physical explanation. Again, the old initiates knew that behind this is the spiritual, that when the Moon is eclipsed, thoughts flow down through the darkness, and that they have a more intimate connection to the human unconscious than to the conscious. These ancient initiates often spoke in parables to their students, so I will translate this into modern language. Romantic people go for walks in the light of the full moon, and those who aspire to receiving from the universe not the good thoughts but those of the devil, they go out at eclipses of the moon. So, here we have again the spiritual aspect of a physical event. We cannot approach these things in the old way. That would only lead to superstition. But we have to aim at seeing the spiritual in particularly important world events. Because in reality, when in each year eclipses of the sun and moon repeat themselves, this is in a sense like opposing safety valves. Safety valves are installed to avoid damage. They open at certain times, so as to let out steam, for example. The valves which appear as the cosmic phenomena of solar and lunar eclipses exist so that in the case of a solar eclipse, the evil that has spread over the earth can be carried out in luciferic fashion into the cosmos to wreak more havoc there. Whereas in the case of a lunar eclipse, people who absolutely want to be possessed by evil thoughts can receive them from the cosmos. Those involved are not fully conscious of this, but nevertheless it is real as the attraction of a magnet is for certain iron filings. These are forces at work in the universe, just like those we study today in the clinic or in the chemistry or physics laboratory. Human beings will not be able to overcome the forces of decadence until they have the courage and the good sense to grasp the power of the spiritual. Then humanity will begin to have true ideas about life and death. And deeply immersed as it is in darkness, humanity needs these true ideas about birth and death. Also, we must learn the meaning of the sun, S-U-N, which sends us light. When the sun sends us light, in a sense it frees up the space around us for the path of the souls of the dead, which must make their way out into the cosmos. When the sun sends its light down to the earth sends its souls out into the cosmos. When people die, they radiate out into the vastness. Out there in the vastness, they go through changes. Then, spiritually formed, they return through the moon sphere and again take up a physical body, provided for them by the stream of physical heredity. Not until we really feel these things can we have a proper connection to the cosmos. Nowadays we study astronomy, spectral analysis, and so on. We learn how the sun's rays penetrate down to the earth, and we think we know all there is to know. We learn how the sun's rays fall onto the moon and are reflected back onto the earth, and physically we can then see moonlight. This preoccupies our minds. But this rational knowledge has little meaning. Rational knowledge separates humanity from the cosmos. It does not vitalize our souls. We can only come alive in our souls when we attain a real soul spiritual connection to the cosmos. We can only attain this by saying again to ourselves, for example, someone has died, their soul is shining toward the sun, and flows out into the cosmos along the path of the sun's rays, until it arrives at where space ends, where the three dimensions stop being the three dimensions, where they become the plane. There processes take place beyond space and beyond time. Then after a while, the soul returns from the opposite direction, from where the light of the moon flows down to us, unites with the physical human body, and comes down again to the earth. We humans must learn to say, O sun, the souls of the dead rise up toward you. O moonlight, on your waves young souls move into earthly life. When we learn to feel how natural phenomena are permeated with the spiritual, then there will be knowledge on earth that is also religion. then there will be knowledge that is also devoutness. Knowledge that is only concerned with the material can not ever become religion, and religion only based on faith and not on knowledge can never unite harmoniously with the insight humanity gains from the cosmos. Today people recite the old prayers, but if you say to them, "There is a profound wisdom in the old prayers," as I did, for example, in that small volume about the Lord's Prayer, then these clever people say, "That is all in your imagination, all fantasy." It is not fantasy. It comes from a deep insight into the fact that these prayers, given to humanity in the tradition from ancient times on, were formulated out of a profound knowledge of cosmic relationships. However, then we have to go beyond our own knowledge to attain what will enable a kind of religious connection to all the various phenomena of the universe. We must be able to say, "O sun, you shine your light on me. Along those trails that your light blazes from you, O sun, to me on the earth, the souls of people who die flow out into the cosmos. O moonlight, you shine gently down on the earth, but on the waves of your gentle light, souls come down from out of the cosmos into their earthly existence." In this way we can find the connection between what shines outside in the world and what lives and works within humanity itself. And we will never again say thoughtlessly, "Outside is the physical universe with all its substances, and we do not know what the human soul will do when it separates from the body in this purely material cosmos." We will know that when the sun's rays blaze down through space, they are working with the rays of the human will, which find their way along the trails its light has prepared. And we will recognize that the moon is not sending out its gentle wave-like light to no purpose, but that in these waves of gentle moonlight the spiritual is flowing through space. Someone who can look at things in this way is not able to remain indifferent to what we can experience through the plant and its behavior, seen in the morning, when the young morning sunlight shines upon it. The plant behaves in a specific manner at that time. The sap, rising in the capillaries, flows into the blossom or leaf-like structures. Here the powers of the sun, which flow into the plant, make way for the will forces of the earth. And it is not only the sap flowing through the plants, as our present-day scientists describe it, but the will forces located deep in the earth, flowing through the plant, through the roots of the flower. In the evenings, when the leaves roll themselves up and close, when the sun's rays no longer offer a path to the streaming of the will, flowing up from the earth, then the plant becomes passive. Its life is on hold. However, it is now exposed to the gentle moonlight. This gentle moonlight affects not only lovers, but the passive plant as well, which flows down to earth with the moonlight, as world thinking is active in the passive plant. Thus we learn to view the plant as an interwoven net of earth willing and world thinking. We can examine each plant form as to how far it is woven together from earth will and world thoughts. And when we learn to recognize how healing forces stream out of the spirit into world thoughts and earth will, then we can understand the healing powers of the plants, and we can recognize the plant as herbal medicine. But we can only really recognize the plant as herbal medicine through an intimate knowledge of the cosmos. This is something we have to relearn. And there is more to relearn. Look at the human head. It is a recreation of the earth itself. Initially, it is formed in the human embryo. It is a recreation of the earth, and the rest is pieced on later, in a sense. When light shines on the human head, as for example when the sun shines, then what is similar to earth will in the human head is beamed out particularly strongly into the universe. Let us now look at the roots of a plant, which contain earth will quite intensively. We know that the roots are not exposed to sunlight, but they are exposed quite strongly to the moonlight, which, while only shining relatively faintly on the earth, still manages to penetrate its surface and reach the roots of the plant. When we expose the plant to light by burning the roots and gathering the ash to make a powder, Then through cosmic processes we can understand how the powder from the root of one plant or another can influence the head, which is similar in the power of its will to that of the earth. It is a question of being able to fathom out in everything, be it the smallest piece or the largest mass of matter, its connection to the spiritual. Then we will be able to do what today is only possible in mathematics. We will be able to apply what we have first understood purely spiritually to the whole of nature. Today we are no further than thinking a cube consists of six faces. We can think this for ourselves. It is just a thought picture. If we look at salt, quite ordinary table salt, nature shows us the cube. Here, what we think, the spiritual, coincides with what is outside in matter. But I ask you, what do people today know about how much in the roots of the plant is spiritual will forces, world thought forces, earth thought forces, and will forces? Yet it is the same process which today we can only carry out in an abstract manner when we have the idea of the cube and then recognize it in sodium chloride, in table salt. What we can only do today with mathematics is what we have to do with everything the human soul can conceive of. Mathematics does not create a devout feeling in many people. Such a thoughtful person as Novalis was able to find a devotional mood even in mathematics, which he saw as a grand and beautiful poem. Not many people can do that. Generally, we will not find many people who become religious through mathematics. However, when we go further, when we explore the spiritual in human beings and carry it out into the world, where it already exists, but we need to recognize it, then science will be transformed into religious feeling. Then we will really create the harmonization of religion and science. This, my dear friends, is what I wanted to say to you today from my heart. The end of Lecture 2.